And welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, January 27, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine suggesting censure of former President Donald Trump for the actions around the Capitol, the attack on the U.S. Capitol, January 6th. And this proposal coming after a test vote in the Senate showing an impeachment trial conviction is unlikely. President Biden signing climate change executive orders, including putting the U.S. on a path to net zero emissions by 2050. Secretary of State Antony Blinken telling department employees he's going to rebuild the Foreign Service and rely on its expertise and repair broken ties with international allies. And the White House coronavirus response team holds its first news conference, promising to always follow the science and be honest with the public, but warning that tens of thousands more will die in the U.S. in the next 4 weeks, and saying it's going to be months before everyone can get a vaccine. CNN reporting Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia saying Wednesday he has drafted a resolution to censure former President Donald Trump for his actions ahead of the January 6th deadly riot at the U.S. Capitol, a method some think would be a faster way to hold Trump accountable than an impeachment trial. Senator Kaine spoke with reporters.
I have been talking with a number of my colleagues, a handful, not, 40, for a couple of weeks about the likelihood that we would fall short on impeachment, and that by doing that, not only would we fall short, but we would use time for something that we could be using for COVID relief, which I think is just so dire right now. And so I've been exploring that, and I think there had been some interest, but the House acted, they sent put papers our way, so we have to do something with it. The vote on the Paul motion yesterday was completely clarifying that we're not going to get near 67 votes. So I think there's maybe a little more interest now, and could this be an alternative? And I have, I've drafted something, I haven't filed it yet, because I'm trying to get other people's ideas about what should be in it. But I'm hoping that we might find it, and it could be an alternative.
So if you use alternative, you mean instead of doing a trial?
I think it might, to do a trial knowing you'll get 55 votes at the max seems to me to be not the right prioritization of our time right now. Obviously, if we do a trial, maybe we could do it fast, but my top priority is COVID relief and getting the, I'm going in for this UN here and getting the Biden cabinet approved. So, but other people have different thoughts. Folks have said it could be, after a trial or something like that. I just don't know that there's going to be more appetite to talk about Donald John Trump after the trial. I think there's going to be an intense desire to do what I want to do, which is do COVID relief.
Senator Tim Kaine with reporters. Another Senate Democrat, though, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, expressing doubts about this censure resolution.
Well, I thought the censure was definitely the idea, the way to go back on Ukraine conditions. We had the first impeachment, it would definitely be, because we knew this, it wasn't there. This is much, much more serious than anything that we've ever seen in our lifetime. And it's really the purpose of having articles of impeachment in the Constitution. So I understand that. And it's really a mechanism, a tool, if you will, to deter. But people look at an impeachment trial as a political trial. If there's a criminal trial or a criminal pathway, maybe we should look at that. I don't want anyone that was involved in this that could have incited this, and that's this bedrock of our, the bedrock of who we are is everyone's innocent until proven guilty. The person has to have a good defense, boom, 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 and all that. But we can see the politics of yesterday, the kind of the vote lined up, you pretty much know where it's going to go. So, I don't know, we all look and make sure that no one ever does this again, never thinks about doing something of a seditious insurrection such as that.
Okay?
Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat. A Republican, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, also asked about this proposal.
Wow, you got me. I didn't realize anybody had introduced one. I know that one has been, that we've been talking about it, but there was nothing introduced on the House side.
Senate side? Senator Kaine and Senator Collins, I don't know if they formally introduced it yet.
They're certainly floating it.
Yes, the idea has been floated, and I had not seen language nor had heard that it had been introduced. So you would be my first news source today. I'll give you credit for that. Yes, I'd be interested in looking at what the language of a censure might be.
Do you think that might be an off-ramp? It certainly looks like impeachment's not going to go. Those aren't there to convict. Does this perhaps give you an avenue to hold the president accountable and also move
the government? I'll have to see exactly what the censure outlines. Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
And joining us now with more is senior reporter with The Hill, Alex Bolton. Thanks for being with us. So, Senator Tim Kaine floating this idea of censure of former President Trump. What kind of reception is it getting?
Well, Kaine just explained to reporters that this censure resolution is something that's in the discussion phase and that he's not even going to introduce it unless he can get 10 Republicans on board with it. And right now, it's not clear that he's going to have 10 Republicans for a censure resolution. And he himself is predicting that this would have to happen in lieu of a trial, because after you have a long impeachment trial, you know, people aren't going to want to spend even more time than debating a censure resolution on Donald J. Trump. He says that my colleagues are going to be sick of talking about Donald Trump and are going to want to move on to other things. So this is being discussed as something in lieu of an impeachment trial. But there are a couple of big problems. Number one, Ken can't even get 10 Republicans to support a censure resolution. That's a big if. And he indicated today that if he doesn't get those 10 Republicans, he's not even going to come out with it. So this is in the discussion phase now. And his partner, Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, you know, she was asked about the details about what exactly would be in the censure resolution. And she said, look, we're putting it together. So this is in the early stages. So one question is whether you can get 10 Republican votes for it or supporters for it. But now the other question is whether the Democrats would be willing to halt the impeachment trial and do this instead. And while Kaine is talking about that, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has vowed a trial will go forward. And there is thinking among many lawmakers on both sides of the aisle that if the House passes an article of impeachment or articles of impeachment and sends them to the Senate, that there is a constitutional duty by the Senate to dispose of those articles, and to do so after a trial and fair process, or due process. So I think it's debatable as to whether, you know, Democrats would be even on board with scrapping an impeachment trial to vote for a censure resolution, even though it's clear that they're going to fall far short of the 67 votes they need to convict Trump on the article of impeachment.
And on that note of falling short, the headline on your story is Senate GOP boxes itself in on impeachment. Explain what that means.
Well, yesterday there was a key procedural vote, and it was on a motion by Senator Rand Paul declaring the impeachment trial of a private citizen, which is what former President Trump now is, a private citizen, that is unconstitutional. And in that motion, Rand Paul pointed out, look, you know, Chief Justice John Roberts isn't even presiding over this. So it's clear that this is not he's arguing that's further evidence that this is not a constitutional proceeding, that the Chief Justice has, you know, kind of, you know, signaled his implicit kind of view of what this proceeding is. So Paul's motion would have declared it unconstitutional. Democrats voted to table the motion, but you had 45 Republican senators voting in support of the motion, voting against tabling it. And so essentially what that means is that you have 45 Republican senators voting in support of a statement that this trial is unconstitutional. And now people are extrapolating, and not just outside observers, but people like Susan Collins and Tim Kaine, you know, people right here in the Senate are saying, look, it's clear that you're not going to get more than 55 Republican votes now. I'm sorry, you're not going to have more than 55 Senate votes to convict Trump on an article of impeachment, that if only 5 Republican senators are willing to say that this process is constitutional, then, you know, that's the end of the game. We know where this is headed. You're not going to get more than 5 votes for conviction. So there was, in effect, it was a summary judgment by the 100-member jury pool, you know, on whether this, you know, trial is fair or not. And you had 45 members of that quasi-jury saying, no, this is not fair. So that pretty much gives you a very good idea of what the maximum number of votes for conviction are. It's 55. You need 67 to actually get a conviction.
We're talking with Alex Bolton with The Hill. Is there any more information on what the thinking is of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell? Just a couple of weeks ago, he's on the floor blaming Donald Trump, at least in part, for the attack on the U.S. Capitol. But then he votes with Senator Paul to say the impeachment is unconstitutional.
Well, from talking to Senator McConnell's colleagues, I think when the majority leader said that he's signaled he's undecided on voting how to vote on impeachment, it was a warning more than anything else to President Trump to watch his behavior. Otherwise, he could have the majority leader, then majority leader, Republican leader, and a whole bunch of other Republicans voting to impeach him or voting to convict him on the article of impeachment. And I think it was a warning shot to the president that don't do something dumb like pardon the rioters or the insurrectionists who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. Don't even think about that, or don't think about doing something else that's outrageous. And now that Trump, stood down after that January 6th debacle and, left office peacefully, and there's a new president in charge, new president in the White House, McConnell is, he's kind of letting that talk and that speculation that he would vote for to convict Trump on an impeachment charge. He's letting that die a quiet death.
And finally, as we were talking about the possible censure resolution, point out that the impeachment trial is essentially on hold for floor action for a couple of weeks. So there's some time to sort of work this out.
Well, I think it's pretty much set in stone. I'm not sure there's that much to work out. I think the only question is how much floor time you want to spend on it. And what the signal the Democrats are sending today after yesterday's vote was that, let's do this as quickly as possible. But, there's already an agreement between McConnell and Schumer that the trial is going to begin on February 9th and that the president has until February 2nd to file his answer with the Secretary of the Senate in response to the summons for the impeachment trial. The House of Representatives has until February 2nd to file a trial brief, and that President Trump, if he wants to file a trial brief, has until February 8th. So there are a bunch of procedural deadlines, that have been put in place, and the trial is going to happen. So I think at this point we're going to have one, and that's what Schumer said. He said he said that this morning on the Senate floor, we're going ahead with the trial, make no mistake about it, and that's the expectation. So this talk of censure, I think, is just kind of on the fringes right now of the caucuses.
Alex Bolton, senior reporter with The Hill. Read more at thehill.com. Follow him on Twitter, at Alexander Bolton. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we learned today a second Capitol Police officer who responded to the attack on the Capitol January 6th committed suicide soon after. It was Officer Jeffrey Smith. A third officer died from injuries that day. The news today coming from Washington, D.C. Acting Police Chief Robert Conti to a closed-door meeting of the House Appropriations Committee. And the Homeland Security Department issuing a national terrorism bulletin this morning, warning of the potential for lingering violence from people motivated by anti-government sentiment after President Biden's election, suggesting the attack on the Capitol may embolden extremists and set the stage for additional attacks. President Joe Biden signing executive actions today dealing with climate change. They include committing the U.S. to conserving 30% of public lands and waters by 2030, stopping new gas and oil drilling leases on public lands or offshore waters, and putting the U.S. on a path to reaching net zero emissions by 2050. Ahead of those signings, John Kerry, the special presidential envoy for climate, took questions at the White House.
Follow up on that, perhaps for Secretary Kerry. How do you assure international partners that the U.S. will stick to whatever you propose after having seen the Trump administration take the U.S. out of the Paris Accord?
Well, that's precisely why we're going to stick by it, and I think our word is strong. I've been on the phone for the last few days talking to our allies in Europe, elsewhere, around the world, and they are welcoming us back. They know that this administration already had a significant part of what has brought us to, will bring us to Glasgow, which was the Paris Agreement. The Obama-Biden administration had great credibility on this issue, and having President Biden be the person now who is driving this forward is enormously meaningful to the folks there. And they also know that I was deeply involved in the negotiations in Paris. and am now asked by the president, by President Biden, to make certain that we do the same at Glasgow, if not more. So I have had no one question our credibility at this point in time. Someone probably will. And the answer will be that I think we can achieve things in the course of the next 4 years that will move the marketplace, the private sector, global finance, innovation and research, that in fact no political person in the future would be able to undo what the planet is going to be organizing over these next months and years. This is the start of something new. I don't know if you read Larry Fink's letter of BlackRock yesterday, but there's a new awareness among major asset managers and commercial banks and others about the need to be putting resources into this endeavor, because it is major in investment demand. So I think the proof will be in what we do. Neither Gina nor I are going to start, you know, throwing around a lot of big promises, but you heard what she just said, and we will work very closely, because we're going to try to bring to the table to help inform her and the folks she's working with what we're picking up abroad and what people are doing abroad and the steps that they're taking and how we now have to measure ourselves against them, and they will measure themselves against us. We are well aware of that.
John Kerry, a special presidential envoy for climate, today in the White House briefing room, mentioned Gina. That's Gina McCarthy, the White House National Climate Advisor. Later, President Joe Biden signing the climate change executive orders in the White House State Dining Room.
Today's executive order also directs the Secretary of the Interior to stop issuing new oil and gas leases on public lands and in offshore waters wherever possible. We're going to review and reset the oil and gas leasing program. Like the previous administration, we'll start to properly manage, unlike it, we're going to start to properly manage lands and waterways in ways that allow us to protect, preserve them, the full value that they provide for us for future generations. Let me be clear. And I know this always comes up. We're not going to ban fracking. We'll protect jobs and grow jobs, including through stronger standards like controls from methane leaks and union workers willing to install the changes. Unlike previous administrations, I don't think the federal government should give handouts to big oil to the tune of $40 billion in fossil fuel subsidies. And I'm going to be going to the Congress asking them to eliminate those subsidies. We're going to take money and invest it in clean energy jobs in America, millions of jobs in wind, solar, and carbon capture. In fact, today's action is going to help us increase renewable energy production from offshore wind and meet our obligation to be good stewards of our public lands.
With more on President Joe Biden's climate change executive orders, joining us now is Washington Post senior national affairs correspondent Juliet Alperin. Can you run down for us what is in the executive orders the president just signed?
Well, there are a slew of policies, so it's hard to cover all of them given the time we've got. But broadly speaking, it elevates climate change to a national security priority and instructs a number of national security officials within the administration to prepare new analyses to make this a priority when dealing with other nations. It formally establishes not just the presidential envoy, but the national climate advisor, who will coordinate an all-of-government approach to curbing greenhouse gas emissions and hold different agencies accountable. It pledges to protect 30% of our lands and waters by the end of the decade. It instructs every agency across the federal government to factor climate change into their decision making. There's a separate executive order on environmental justice, which really makes that central to decision making, not just in traditional environmental agencies, but in, say, the Department of Justice, where there'll be a new office devoted to this, the Health and Human Services Department, where there'll be a new office of racial equity when it comes to climate change. So it's really setting in motion. In addition, it halts all new oil and gas leasing on federal lands and in federal waters. So it's really the most sweeping action we've seen from a president on climate and the environment this early in a term.
And President Joe Biden made this a key campaign promise. Did he go far enough to satisfy the progressives in the Democratic Party?
It appears that he has at this point. I mean, there absolutely are some individuals and groups who are still saying he could go further. But you have, for example, the youth activist group, the Sunrise Movement, praising what the president is doing. You have Democratic politicians across the political spectrum praising it. So in terms of his own party and his own base, he is really delivering on a number of his more ambitious climate and environmental pledges.
And what has been the reaction from the Republicans?
The Republicans, not surprisingly, have been sharply critical of these moves, both, you know, Republican lawmakers as well as, for example, the oil and gas industry really are a bit taken aback by the extent to which Biden has followed through on what he said he would do, whether it's rescinding the cross-border permit for the Keystone XL pipeline, which is what he did on his first day, or this step to halt new leases for oil and gas offshore as well as onshore. They're arguing that in the midst of an economic downturn, this is a potentially disastrous move. And, you know, for example, I interviewed Senator Dan Sullivan, a Republican from Alaska, who said that even the Obama administration endorsed the idea of an on all of the above approach and wouldn't have adopted these kinds of policies.
We're talking with Washington Post reporter Juliet Alperin. You lead your story with the environmental justice commitment from President Biden. That really is breaking new ground, isn't it?
Yeah, we found that kind of in many ways the most historic part of this set of announcements. You know, again, the president had already indicated, you know, many of these other policy positions during the campaign. And while he had talked about the importance of helping disadvantaged communities, particularly low-income communities and those of color, what we're seeing with this is really an unprecedented commitment to taking into account the needs of these disadvantaged groups. Part of the executive order, for example, dictates that 40% of federal investment in sustainability, and that includes anything from energy efficiency to new infrastructure, would be in these disadvantaged communities. And it's just worth noting that, you know, the only other president to really make environmental justice an issue was President Clinton, who in 1994 assigned the first executive order on this issue. But in practice, that didn't have a huge impact over time in how the federal government makes decisions. And so what we're seeing is really a wholesale change and a response to kind of the calls for racial equity.
Read more at WashingtonPost.com. Juliet Alperin, senior national affairs correspondent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And climate change and oil and gas drilling also came up today at a confirmation hearing for Energy Secretary nominee Jennifer Granholm. The question's coming from Republican Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming.
The United States is the world's largest oil and natural gas producer, just a fact. On balance, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It is a good thing, and I look forward to working with you to make sure that it's clean and, yeah, and reduces GHG emissions.
And the United States has, if not the lowest, then among the lowest energy prices in the developed world. Again, on balance, a good thing or bad thing?
Good thing, of course.
Jobs in oil, natural gas, and coal sectors pay well above the national average. On balance, good thing.
Good thing, of course.
Largely because of hydraulic fracturing, U.S. emissions are now at the lowest level since the early 1990s. On balance, good thing.
Yes.
And U.S. oil exports, natural gas exports, coal exports to other countries make us influential suppliers in the global energy markets. Good thing.
It's important to be influential in the global energy market, yes.
So last week, the Biden administration issued a 60-day ban on oil, gas, coal leasing, and permitting on federal lands and waters. Half of the state of Wyoming is federally owned. Alaska, it's a lot higher percentage than that. Did President Biden or his advisors seek your counsel on the ban?
I knew that it was coming. It was part of the campaign promise of President Biden.
Did you encourage him to issue the ban then?
I didn't have a specific conversation with him about it myself.
You know, a long-term ban on oil gas leasing is going to cost about 62,000 jobs in New Mexico, and we have the senator from New Mexico here, about 33,000 jobs in Wyoming, 18,000 jobs in Colorado. A long-term ban is going to cut revenues to New Mexico and Wyoming by hundreds of millions of dollars, which these states use for K-2 public education, other essential services. I'm just curious how a long-term ban consistent with the president's goal of unifying our country and putting Americans back to work and helping our economies grow, how is that all consistent?
I think the president's plan of building back better, which would create more jobs in energy, clean energy, than the jobs that might be sacrificed. But I will say this, no job, we don't want to see any jobs sacrificed. And that's why this, when you opened up your remarks, sir, your remarks about technology were so important. This is why reducing GHG emissions is so important in the fossil fuel arena. The moratorium on public lands, I know for those states that have these jobs in abundance, this is something we're going to have to work on together to ensure that people remain employed.
Energy Secretary nominee Jennifer Granholm, a former governor of Michigan, testifying today before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, questions from Senator John Barrasso. The Energy Department also oversees national research labs and nuclear weapons stockpiles. Just one of a number of hearings being covered by the C-SPAN networks on cabinet nominations. Another one, as USA Today reports, President Joe Biden's nominee to be U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said she regretted giving a speech in 2019 at a Chinese-funded institute in Savannah, remarks that quickly became a flashpoint at her confirmation hearing on Wednesday. You can find that hearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and all the hearings covered by C-SPAN in full at our video library at cspan.org. This from the Associated Press. America's new top diplomat took the helm at the State Department on Wednesday with a vow to rebuild the ranks of the Foreign Service and rely on its expertise as the Biden administration tries to restore U.S. global standing. The top diplomat is Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
We've never been in a moment quite like this before. The president is committed to getting us through it as quickly as possible so that very soon we can all gather in person again and have confidence that the foundations of our democracy are strong. We at State have a role to play in all of this, and I believe it starts with rebuilding morale and trust. This is a priority for me because we need a strong department for the United States to be strong in the world. To that end, we have to invest significantly in building a diverse and inclusive State Department. We need the most talented people. We need the most creative workforce. We cannot do our job of advancing America's interests, values, and commitment to democracy without a State Department that is truly representative of the American people. Now, I can't promise that you will support every choice I make as your secretary, but I can promise an open door and an open mind. I'll be forthright with you, because transparency makes us stronger. I'll seek out dissenting views and listen to the experts, because that's how the best decisions are made. And I will insist that you speak and speak up without fear or favor. And I will have your back. One of the great attributes of our foreign and civil services throughout history has been your nonpartisanship. You serve Democratic and Republican presidents alike because you put country over party. All we ask is that you serve the United States, the Constitution, and the President to the best of your ability. I know you'll do that. The world is watching us intently right now. They want to know if we can heal our nation. They want to see whether we will lead with the power of our example, if we'll put a premium on diplomacy with our allies and partners to meet the great challenges of our time, like the pandemic, climate change, the economic crisis, threats to democracies, fights for racial justice, and the danger to our security and global stability posed by our rivals and adversaries.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the State Department today. First full day on the job. He was confirmed by the Senate Tuesday before a reduced crowd due to the coronavirus pandemic. Russian President Vladimir Putin praising this week's agreement with the U.S. to a 5-year extension of the New START treaty limiting strategic nuclear weapons. But Putin telling the World Economic Forum in a virtual speech, in an apparent reference to the U.S., the era marked by attempts to create a centralized unipolar global order is now over. Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. The top spending lobbying group in the U.S. in 2020 was the National Association of Realtors, $84 million. That, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, that's just a bit more than second place U.S. Chamber of Commerce. That chamber had held the top spot for 20 years. Third position is the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, also known as PhRMA. This is Holocaust Remembrance Day, and today the Anti-Defamation League has put out a ranking of the worst digital platforms in responding to Holocaust denial. The worst: Facebook, Reddit, Discord, and Steam. And former First Lady Melania Trump opening an office in Palm Beach, Florida, sources tell CNN, to maintain her Be Best initiative that she championed while in the White House. That initiative focusing on children's health and well-being, safety online, and prevention of social media bullying, and the impact of the opioid crisis on children. From the Associated Press, as many as 90,000 Americans are projected to die from the coronavirus in the next 4 weeks, Biden administration warning in its first science briefing on the COVID-19 pandemic, as experts outlined efforts to improve the delivery and injection of COVID-19 vaccines. Jeff Zients, the White House COVID-19 response coordinator, set the stage for what is expected to be regular briefings.
The president believes the federal government should be the source of truth for the public to get clear, accessible, and scientifically accurate information about the pandemic. We will not always know the answers to your questions.
Hello?
When we don't, we will tell you. We will update you on our progress, and we will be open about any setbacks along the way. We will always be transparent and straightforward with all of you.
Jeff Zients, today's White House briefing held virtually. Many states reporting a vaccine shortage. President Biden last night promising to increase supply to vaccinate 300 million Americans by the end of the summer or early fall. Another participant in today's briefing, Andy Slavitt, COVID-19 senior advisor, said it will take months before everyone in the U.S. who wants a vaccine can get one.
As you heard us announce yesterday, any stockpile that may have existed previously no longer exists. Our practice is to maintain a rolling inventory of 2 to 3 days of supply that we can use to supplement any shortfalls in production and to ensure that we are making deliveries as committed. But we are passing doses directly along to states very much in real time as they order them. And we are confident that we will receive the supply on a rolling basis from the manufacturers to allow us to continue to do so.
Andy Slavitt, also part of today's White House coronavirus science briefing, Dr. Marcella Nunez-Smith, the chair of the COVID-19 Equality Task Force, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She said her agency predicts up to 514,000 pandemic deaths by February 20th. The current total is over 427,000. Also there, Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He discussed how effective the coronavirus vaccines approved so far are against the virus variants that are now emerging.
The important question that people ask is, what is the impact on both monoclonal antibodies and on the vaccine-induced antibodies related to the vaccines that we are currently distributing now? when you're looking at the 117, namely what we refer to as the UK variant, what we're seeing is a very slight, if at all, impact on vaccine-induced antibodies and very little impact on anything else. So we are covered with that. Things get a bit more problematic when you go to the 351, or what we're seeing as the dominant one in South Africa, because in that regard, there is a moderate diminution, namely a multifold diminution in the in vitro neutralization by vaccine-induced antibodies. However, and this is an important however, it still is well within the cushion of protection. So you could diminish the vaccine-induced antibody efficacy by a few fold and still be well within the protective range of the vaccine. And that's the reason why you've seen announcements that actually the vaccines that we're using are still effective. However, given that as a fact now, we have to be concerned looking forward at what the further evolution of this might be. Now, I want to make one mention about the monoclonal antibodies, because they are more seriously inhibited in the sense of impacting on their efficacy by this South African strain. That's the reason why there will be attempts to develop even other antibodies that might be able to avert this particular problem.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, top U.S. infectious disease expert. White House plans to hold these coronavirus response briefings with scientists three times per week. The Federal Reserve, in its meeting today, making no policy changes, keeping short-term interest rates near zero and keeping the asset purchasing program going that has the Fed buying at least $120 billion each month. But the Fed, in a statement, saying the pace of the recovery in economic activity and employment has moderated in recent months, with weakness concentrated in the sectors most adversely affected by the pandemic. The Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, asked today by a reporter about President Joe Biden's proposed $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package.
Last year, you consistently said that the economy needed more fiscal support, and I believe we're pleased when the $900 billion package was approved in December. We now have a new president, a new Congress. We have a weakening short-term outlook. Do you believe the economy still needs additional support on the fiscal side, and in what areas?
Thank you. So I guess I'd start by saying that the fiscal response that we've seen to this downturn has been strong, and I think we can say now that it's been sustained after the passage of the most recent act in late December. And that's really a key reason why the recovery has been as strong as it's been. Fiscal policy has been absolutely essential. When we look back on the history of this period, we'll see a strong and sustained fiscal policy response. I would add that we're, as I mentioned, a long way from a full recovery. Something like 9 million people remain unemployed as a consequence of the pandemic. That's as many people as lost their jobs at the peak of the global financial crisis and the Great Recession. Many small businesses are under pressure, and there are other needs to be addressed. And the path ahead is still pretty uncertain. So all of that said, the judgment on how much to spend and in what way is really one for Congress and the administration and not for the Fed. And these discussions are going on right now. So there's a discussion, as you know, right now around those precise questions, and that's appropriate, but not for us to play a role in talking about specific policies.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell in a virtual news conference. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 633, NASDAQ down 355, S&P down 98. An article at Politico begins, one of the premier MAGA gatherings in the nation is struggling to recreate the magic this year. That gathering is CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. And joining us now, one of the reporters who wrote the story, Gabby Orr, who covers the White House for Politico. What are some of the struggles that they are facing?
Well, thanks for having me on. There's a lot of struggles happening right now inside the American Conservative Union, which is the group that hosts this annual CPAC conference. You know, for starters, there's the coronavirus pandemic, which has really created a moment where they have to look outside of the Washington, D.C. area for the first time in nearly 50 years to actually be able to host this conference, which typically draws anywhere between, you know, a few hundred to a little over 1,000 attendees every year. So for the first time in nearly 50 years, this conference will take place in Orlando, Florida, instead of the Washington, D.C. area. That creates some logistical hurdles because, you know, Orlando is a great deal further for Republican lawmakers to travel to actually be able to attend this conference and speak at it than just across the Potomac in Maryland. So they're having difficulty booking speakers for the CPAC conference. The second thing that we really talked to sponsors about was the fact that there's a few sponsors that haven't actually signed on to pay for sponsorships this year, that they weren't satisfied in past years with the return on their investment. These are costly sponsorships that can cost, you know, anywhere between $3,000 to $250,000. So it is a big investment for a lot of these groups to make, and some of them just simply aren't willing to do it this year. And then third, the president, the former president, Donald Trump, has yet to even agree to show up at this conference. If you've watched any part of the CPAC coverage over the last couple of years, it's definitely been a main attraction for President Donald Trump and his supporters and MAGA icons that are part of his movement. And yet it's not even sure, you know, three weeks out from the conference, if Trump himself plans to make an appearance.
There's another great line from your article. It's ACU Chair Matt Schlapp said he is convinced this year's conference will be no different from past years. CPAC is going great, he told Politico on Tuesday, before then saying that his quote needed to be attributed without his name. What do you make of that?
Well, look, I think CPAC is extremely sensitive right now to any suggestion that they're struggling to put together a conference this year that would be as successful as previous years. This conference is going to be pretty much the largest gathering of grassroots conservative activists and Republican activists following the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. So there's a lot of eyes on CPAC waiting to see, you know, what indication it provides on the state of former President Trump's movement and then also of the conservative movement writ large. And so I think they're hesitant to say or to admit that they're struggling, but based on our phone calls, based on our reporting and talking to former sponsors and talking to former speakers, they are definitely having a tough time booking those same sponsors and those speakers heading into next month's conference.
We're talking with Gabby Orr of Politico. To put a finer point on that, is the struggle that we've seen in defining what the Republican Party is, there's sort of it's playing out with the impeachment trial right now on Capitol Hill. People who continue to support former President Trump and others who are appalled at what happened, is that also playing out within CPAC and its sponsors and the guests they're trying to book?
Well, there's definitely a debate happening within the CPAC planning committee and the organizers who are involved in booking speakers and putting this thing together over, you know, how much influence Donald Trump should have over not only the agenda and the topics that are discussed, but also the speaker lineup. Should it be like previous years where, you know, you had more than 24 Trump administration officials speak at the conference, the president himself, the vice president, his adult children, or should it be a moment where this group that's, you know, been around since 1974 hosting this annual conference brings the conversation back to the founding ideas of the conservative movement? One source I spoke with who is part of the CPAC planning process said, you know, do we pull the Nancy Pelosi option and try to expunge Trump from public life? Or do we try to build on the movement he created and make it tenable? It's messy, this person said. So it definitely is a question that's sort of looming over the planning committee and one that will be determined probably in the next couple of weeks.
Gabby Orr, White House reporter for Politico. Read her work at Politico.com or follow her at Gabby Orr_ on Twitter. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Republican National Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel saying today that the National Republican Party will stay neutral in the next presidential primary, even if former President Donald Trump decides to make another run for the White House in 2024. McDaniel doing an interview with the Associated Press. Thanks for joining us on Washington Today. Download the free C-SPAN radio app to listen anywhere and get our podcasts, including of this program, wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Hope you have a good evening.